Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Vaughn Scribner. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas, and we're talking about his book, Merpeople, A Human History. Vaughn, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
I couldn't be more happy to be here, Mark. Thanks so much. I'm really excited to talk about the book.
I love getting books like this because it's like I just sat down and I just went through the whole book. Not that it's easy reading, but I just it's interesting, it's entertaining, and it's fascinating all in the same one. How did you come to this subject?
It's a really funny story, actually, and I've been reflecting upon this recently in that I'm probably never going to have another experience like this in my academic writing and researching career. So my main field of, quote, expertise and what I study is 18th century British and British American history. And for my first book's on colonial American taverns, and I've written on, you know, British, everything from the British slave trade to the royal family to all kinds of stuff in 18th century. But something that I have to do a lot for my research is I'm constantly reading 18th century newspapers and travel narratives and diaries. Well, I was reading one diary from the 18th century and of this pretty well-respected naturalist who claimed that he saw a merman clamber up into the side of one of his canoes, one of his men's canoes, and they chopped its arm off and it fell into the water. This was in America. And it bled purple blood. And I thought, what is going on here? And I just put that, I was doing other things. So I put this reference aside. Like, I'll come back to this. If nothing else, I'll get a funny Twitter post out of it. Well, the very next day, I'm reading the Pennsylvania Gazette, published by Benjamin Franklin. And it reports a merman sighting in Europe. And at this point, I thought, something's going on here. I've got
to get
to the bottom of this. Yeah. And it just exploded from there. I found so much interesting stuff, and it led to, you know, some academic articles, some blog posts, a cover for History Today magazine in the UK, a cover article, and then eventually Reaction Books reached out to me to write this book. And really, I'm glad you had an easy time reading the book because it kind of wrote itself.
It comes off that way. And that's why it's great to read. What's fascinating about it is especially is reading these reports of people actually confronting mermaids. But there's so much more in this book. The book covers from about 1,000 years before the Common Era to today. And as you point out in the book, ideas and mythologies and stories and sightings of mer people are all over the globe. It's like a common theme. Yes.
Mark, it's bizarre. Two threads here. One, I always have to tell people when I mention I wrote this book that I don't believe in mermaids.
You're getting close there.
Now, here's the thing, though. I also kind of follow that up with, I have no idea what these people were seeing. Because one of the strangest things is that these men and women who are seeing and reporting a lot of these mermaids and mermen are trusted people.
You have
people like Benjamin Franklin and Cotton. And it's at some point, you kind of throw your hands up and say, I don't know. Because people oftentimes want an answer.
The common story that you hear is that they're seeing seals or manatees.
Yes.
And and even as a kid when I read that, I went, there's no way somebody's seeing a manatee and then mistaking it for a mermaid.
Well, and you know, something you mentioned the ancient depictions from around the world.
Yeah.
Something that I've really thought about a lot is the fact that these people were growing up surrounded by mer culture, if you will. Depictions of mermaids in the church, for instance. And if you go out expecting to find something, it's more likely that you will, I suppose. I think also it could have given you some kind of cultural or social capital to say, like, I saw this, and people, oh, really? I can't believe you saw this. But then it goes back to the chicken or the egg question. So where did these come from in the first place? How is it that, in the book I mentioned this, I found ancient rock art in the South African Karoo Desert, depicting merpeople.
Wow.
Instances in South American art, African art, Middle Eastern art. You have instances of the two-legged, the two-finned mermaid, if you will, that's now become so popularized by the Starbucks logo. But there are ancient peoples depicting this mermaid way before Westerners ever did, or at the same time, at least, when they weren't in contact with them, in the Middle East and Africa. So I just don't know.
This is starting to sound like the truth is out there.
I know, that's what's, and that, okay, so I always follow up, and I get laughs, and I kind of use
I know. For a laugh. Well, like, but you know, I'm Mr. Skeptic level-headed, too. Then I read this book, and it's like, well, what is going on? I mean, why is this thing so universal?
A lot of reviewers in the piece have said, you know, a lot of people way smarter than me who've reviewed this book in pretty popular, quite popular outlets have even finished with it. At some point, you have to just kind of let yourself wonder what is this? And I follow up that I don't believe in mermaids, but I have a but. I say, but I don't know if I'd necessarily be surprised if we found out at some point they were real. Or maybe they still are. You know, because there's always that caveat, we've only explored 5% of the ocean.
I know. And if anything would be adept at avoiding our contact, it would be merpeople.
Exactly. Yeah, and, you know, I mentioned, too, something that the reason that the subtitle is A Human History is because we basically, as humanity, have projected what we want.
Well, let's talk about that a bit, because that's one of the brilliant things about this book is when you look at these stories, or at least the myths, and how it was used as a symbol, say, in the medieval church, we're really looking at the merpeople as representing something within the human mind and culture. And I want to talk about it. You describe them as volatile entities wedded to a variety of equally volatile ideologies. Mm-hmm. And it's really true. Let's talk about it's something. There's something about their hybridity. That's a word you use.
Yes.
Talk about that. Elaborate on that.
Yeah, well, you know, I kind of my tagline for the book is that this book uses merpeople to explore, what is it, the most capricious, dangerous creatures on Earth, humans. Because one of my big points is that we're hybrid.
Yep.
We as humans, we're all walking contradictions. We're these constantly, you know, more than just two, we're multi-hybrids, if you could be that way. And so in this way, merpeople, mermaids and mermen are just really reflections of ourselves. We create them largely. And in doing so, we adjust what we expect out of them as our kind of our concerns, I wouldn't say evolve, but transform over time. So going back to the early Christian church, you know, a lot of times people really want to start with like 5,000 BCE, with, you know, ancient Syrian cultures and things creating these kind of ideas of merpeople and then, you know, go through the Odyssey. And I think there's real value in that. But my kind of big point is that our idea of mermaids and mermen to an extent come from the medieval Christian church.
As a matter of fact, the Assyrians, they talk mostly about mermen, don't they? I mean, what they show.
Yes, totally.
They're mermen.
Totally.
And it's not until you get to the medieval church that all of a sudden all these real sexy mermaids are coming out.
1,000,000%. And something that one of my colleagues who does medieval history, because that's been another thing with this book, is it forced me to broaden my scope both temporally and geographically. And so I did a lot of collaboration with, you know, asking. I'm never afraid to ask questions to other people. So one of the glories of this book was I was able to reach out to all these experts in other fields and kind of bounce ideas off of them. And as one of them mentioned, Dr. David O'Hara, who's in my department, mentioned that the nude female form would have been very rare in medieval art. And to have them so, if you will, you know, brazenly displayed in these spaces of worship would have really been an affecting.
The examples that you show in your book, they're extremely weird. I mean, they're purposely baring their breasts. They're spreading their two tails apart, exposing their.
Exactly.
Now, here's a term I never thought I'd know. The mermaid's reproductive areas, their vesica piscis.
Yes, yes.
So well, they're actually like flashing inside the church.
Totally. To remind these male leaders in the church and followers of the dangers of the feminine, basically. And it kind of goes all along with the transformation of the church in the early medieval period is trying to be a more masculine space.
Right, right.
And in my experience, I lead study abroad tours to the UK, well, until COVID hit, pretty regularly. And I go with my students, and we'll go into these medieval churches, and as a way to get them to explore the church and really kind of take in the art, I'll say, hey, find a mermaid for me in here. Let's see if you can do it. And they almost always do, at least one in any medieval church. And so it's just this interesting kind of confluence and norm there. But I guess it goes back to where these people are. The medieval church was the most important space that in everyday life in early modern Europe. And if you see these mer people in there, it's going to automatically give it some kind of legitimacy. So there's this kind of this irony in that, in trying to decenter the feminine and everything, that early medieval Christian church actually legitimized mermaids.
Where were they getting their information about mermaids? Some of it was from ancient Roman sources, like Pliny the Elder, for instance.
Uh-huh. And this is where they're definitely getting it from Pliny the Elder. And there, it's once again, it goes back to this kind of weird origin thing, though. We don't really know. This idea of where they definitely take this idea of fish-tailed, creatures, half human, half fish, from some ancient sources. But you also have to remember that there were all sorts of other weird hybrid creatures in these bestiaries they were producing at this time. And I think something about the mermaid just caught on more. A lot of it was probably this fascination with the sea. You see the mermaids, especially catching on in England, Ireland, Scotland, Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, these seafaring nations where they have this, once again, this kind of hybrid identity of this equal respect for the sea and need for it, but also a deep abiding kind of fear. And you have the same emotions wrapped up in mermaids. So I think there's something there too, and I also think sex sells at some point.
Right. I mean, there it was definitely about sexuality and danger.
Mm-hmm. 1,000,000%. And I got and like you were mentioning earlier, these were very, erotic images to have in these books and these carvings within the church space.
I find that so bizarre. Because
me too.
Because they're really being very enticing, but you're not supposed to be attracted to it.
Well, and that's exactly the thing about the mermaid too, is that most of the mermaids don't have this reproductive organ. Most of them aren't spread tailed, so they kill men. I mean, originally they're these sirens. There's nothing's going to happen, basically. So it's this weird, it's this very odd hybrid sexual thing that comes out of the early modern Christian church. And there aren't many depictions of mermen in the Christian church.
Yeah,
in fact,
weird.
When they are depicted, they're often depicted as mer-monks or mer-bishops, where they're in full garb, they're fully covered up, and they're depicted kind of as these very staid, respectable reflections of the monks and the churchmen themselves.
A while ago you mentioned sirens, and you think about Ulysses and other Greek and Roman myths about sirens. When you look at their depictions of the sirens, they weren't fish people at all. Weren't they more bird people?
Yes. Well, and that's the thing too, is you think about the Odyssey, they didn't have fish tails. They were these sirens with their siren song, but they weren't depicted as having tails. They weren't depicted as half women, half fish. But later on in the early modern period, when they show these scenes, they show them, these very scenes of the Odyssey. And I have an instance of a book from 1483 depicting Noah's Ark, where you have Noah on his ark with all these animals, but you also have mermaids swimming around the ark, and the people are basically scared and inside the ark because they're worried that these mermaids are going to get them. So that's something that I just have to kind of, historians of all these books I've read about mer people, no one's really come up with a good explanation for how they became half fish, half woman.
You know, it's interesting. In the case of Noah, they weren't going to be affected by the flood because they were mermaids.
No, exactly. Well, and it goes back to this, you know, this flood myth, it's a common story in basically every religion throughout the world. They have this flood story and even different names for Noah. But it also goes back to this legitimacy of merpeople, where by the 18th century, scholars are arguing that the world began, humans came from the ocean. Well, if you're believing that, then it only makes sense that there could be these hybrid half human, half fish.
Yeah.
After all, as I joke with my students a lot, they were coming across platypus and the possums, which are these crazy, weird hybrid creatures, mammals that lay eggs, mammals that have their babies in pockets in there. And so they're coming across all these new worlds and these new wonders. And it only makes sense for a lot of them that perhaps mermaids and mermen are among those.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Vaughn Scribner. He's assistant professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas. And we're talking about his book. It is a great read. Merpeople, A Human History. One of the other things you talk about, Vaughn, is that the existence of merpeople demonstrate God's ability to alter his own laws. So it sort of seemed to make sense. Yeah, this was an example that God could do this to us. It was, and everything was a reflection of things that we should learn from in the world, because humans were thought to be the crown of creation. Therefore,
yes,
mermaids were put there by God to teach us, I guess, not to get seduced in the water.
Yes, exactly. And this actually comes up a lot throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. Because you have different people kind of using merpeople both to, like you said, support this idea of God's power over humanity, and, you know, his ability to basically do what he wanted. But you also have other people start to argue against this and wonder whether, you know, that you have these origins of evolution coming about with eventually Darwin's ideas of evolution. A lot of people are going to mock his ideas of evolution and use the mermaid to do and say, well, what are you talking about? But even as early as 1748, a French naturalist wrote his Telemed, which he deemed the ocean wholly responsible for the geographic and geologic structure of Earth's surface, and said that humans came from the ocean, this marine origin of human races. And this really angered a lot of people, other scientists even, this idea that he's kind of sidestepping God and saying that humans came from the ocean and that mermaids are an example of this. Some people really, really didn't like this. Another French philosopher said, what a folly in this author to substitute Telemed for Moses, to bring man out of the depths of the sea, and for fear that we should ascend from Adam, to give us marine monsters for ancestors. And so only a kind of godlessness could invent such dreams. So in him trying to challenge this, he gets a lot of kickback. But guess what? The Telemed was the sixth most popular volume in French libraries in the 18th century. So it's this weird push and pull there, where mermaids and mermen become central figures in this argument over God's might or this more kind of secular idea of the creation and evolution of humanity.
As you write about, the age of exploration, the whole idea of mermaids sort of picks up steam because people expected to see tremendously unusual things the further they got away from the center of the world, which they considered Jerusalem. This is, we're talking about the Christian nations.
Yes.
That was the center of the world. The further you got from it, the weirder things got.
Yes, most definitely. And that really plays into a lot of this, and that in the, you know, 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, their furthest reaches that they're hitting initially are South Africa, you know, the west coast and southern tip of Africa, and then, of course, North and South America and the Caribbean. And I created a time-coded map.
It's a great map. It's a great map. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really fun to create. And I have color-coded, you know, pre-17th century, or pre-16th century, 17th century, 18th century, of showing where these verified sightings occurred. And it's basically you're tracing European empires stretching farther and farther out into the far reaches of the earth. And then finally, just to wrap that up, it's no coincidence that by the 19th century, Europeans are buying these strange fake mermaids called niños from Japan, because they think of Japan as this very exotic place. Well, and of course they might have these little mer people that they've preserved. It only makes sense.
Well, let's talk about those for a minute, because there's a whole era of specimens that start to be exhibited. And it's like sort of the late 1800s into the early 1900s. The funny thing is, what a disappointment when you finally see the specimens. And what they are, obviously, are the four parts of a sort of desiccated monkey jammed onto a fish, the rear half of a fish. But first of all, they're really small.
They're tiny. The British Museum holds one. So my favorite room at the British Museum is basically the Enlightenment room, where it's just this big. In the 18th century, in the Enlightenment, they would have had these naturalists and philosophers would have had a cabinet of curiosity, which could be a whole room of Grundercommons. Right. And that's what this is. It's this huge room with all of these specimens and things that people would have been collecting during the 18th century to understand and order the world around them. Well, they have a little, they're a Fiji mermaid, as they call them. They have one in there, and it's very unimpressive. And that's how a lot of people felt when they saw them in the early 19th century and mid to mid 19th century. Like, wait a minute, this doesn't look like these depictions. But that even airs it some legitimacy, because they're like, oh, well, it's this ugly little creature. That makes more sense in some ways, that it might be more real. And you see the same thing happening in the 18th century when you have well-respected artists drawing these supposed specimens from life and printing them in publications like the Gentleman's Magazine, which was a very elite publication in London, where they're presenting these uglier mermaids with scales next to them and almost presenting them like a specimen, like a scientific specimen.
Well, so, the other specimens started to show up too, like people exhibit mermaid hands.
And
bones and stuff like that they supposedly
get.
And one of the great exhibitors, of course, and we have to give him his due, P.T. Barnum exhibit, the most famous Fiji mermaid.
Yes, he both spikes and destroys interest and belief in the legitimacy of merpeople with this. He ends up buying his mermaid, if you will, off of an English sea captain who had gone over to Japan and sold his ship that wasn't his for one of these mermaids, and brings it back to London in the early 1820s. And he's convinced it's real. He's going to make his fortune off of this.
He has a flurry of
advertisements. But where he goes wrong is I don't know how confident he is. He invites physicians to come in and look at the mermaid and verify its legitimacy. But he swears them to secrecy, where they can't give their findings. Well, they all, of course, were like, this is fake. There are metal rods in this. This is obviously a fabrication. But then he pays one of them off to say, no, this is real. Well, he ends up losing his hat on this. And then P.T. Barnum swoops in, buys it, and tours in America with it and makes a ton of money until physicians and naturalists come in and start to say, this is a hoax. This is buggery. P.T. Barnum's mermaid becomes basically synonymous with total fabrication. You even have people using his mermaid to lambast the American Civil War and how America, like a mermaid, are two incongruous halves sewed together. And it's believed that it burns down when his museum burns down. It's burned when his museum burns down. But there are still plenty of Fiji mermaids floating around that claim to be P.T. Barnum. I think there's one in Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum. Yep. Right now, that claims that.
Now, we only have a few minutes left, and we can't do this book justice. Okay. But when you get to the 20th century, after all of that we just talked about, you would think, well, that's the end of the mermaid.
Yeah.
And that's completely not true, because it's all over film and television and advertisements.
Oh, totally.
I have to tell you this. I was at a beach here in New England just 2 years ago, and all of a sudden there was a huge photo shoot of a bunch of women who wanted to be posed as mermaids. So they had all these incredibly elaborate mermaid costumes, yes. and they were being posed on rocks and in the ocean, and it was wild.
That's booming right now, this mermaiding culture. In fact, CNN just came out with an article about 3 or 4 days ago about how it's booming in China right now, going back to this global interest in mermaids. And I joke, I say it in the book, and this is something I say all the time now, is that mermaids are everywhere.
They
if
are.
You look for them, you'll find them.
Everybody's got mermaid hair. Mermaid hair is a huge deal.
Exactly. And in the 20th century, they become tied up in this capitalistic, you know, advertisement boom. So now they're suddenly on tuna cans, and they're the mascot for the largest, you know,
Jansen's shirts has a real sexy series of ads with mermaids.
Oh, really? Oh, the Jansen ones. Yes, oh, the Jansen ones. Yeah, sorry, I missed those. Yes, Jansen shirts. And that's the other thing. In the early 20th century, 1920s through the 60s, you have some very risque, depictions of mermaids in popular culture. Stuff that wouldn't fly today, I feel like. I mean, fully nude women and things, these mermaid depictions. So the advertisers really lean into kind of this medieval depiction of mermaids.
Well, look at the movie Splash. Splash really, it's a whole erotic aspect of mermaids again.
Totally. And you even have one of the original first pornographic films is a mermaid film. it's this weird thing that comes about.
We're gonna have to stop right there because we're out of time.
Okay.
Are gonna have to read this book. It has got all this in it and a lot more.
Yes.
My guest tonight is Von Scribner, assistant professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas. And we've been talking about his book, Mer People, A Human History. There is an awful lot that we didn't even get a chance to talk about. Von, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.